On Senate Bill 510, Charlie Williamson.
Madam Chair, with members of the committee, my name is Charles Williamson. I'm an attorney for Legal Aid Service in Portland. I've got some material, mainly some newspaper articles from the past few months that have come out on mental health in Oregon, relating to mental health. An Oregonian editorial endorsing Senate Bill 510, which I'll pass around. The for your information. As the Legal Aid Service in Portland, we've represented several low-income people being committed to state hospitals. We find many of our clients have mental problems. We became concerned about the area of commitment, three areas in the area of commitment. These were first when a person was taken from their home quite often early in the morning, 7:30, sometimes even in their bathroom, and had a hearing at court 9 o'clock. Seldom did they have counsel. The hearings were perfunctory, 5 or 10 minutes often, and some people that were really elderly, harmless, but in some respects out of touch with reality, were committed. Although there's really not much that could be done for them, and they were perfectly able to function outside of a hospital. Mm-hmm. Third problem we saw was with leak commitment to the institution on a trial visit status. People were placed on trial visits for an indeterminate length of time and committed sometimes 2 or 3 years later since their original commitment. Now, there's been a couple of court cases. There's an article by Robert Landauer in front of you with those newspaper clippings that describe some of the court cases where now they do have to provide counsel. They cannot bring people back from trial visit at any time without giving them some sort of a hearing. So Senate Bill 510 reflects some of the changes that the courts have, or the Constitution has required that the law make. We endorse the bill very much. We think it will really be of great assistance to legal aid or just low-income people in general. The public defender has taken over handling defense of indigents who are being committed to mental hospitals in Multnomah County. I don't know if the public defender is here yet, but he does have a fairly impressive array of statistics on what happens with pre-hearing investigations and I think with the pre-hearing investigation of 63 cases, only 10 that they pre-screened, only 10 ended up being committed. And as a result of the pre-hearing investigation, people get channeled into community resources and commitment is avoided. There are a couple of changes we'd like to propose in the bill. Pass those around. A couple of them are aimed at what Judge Spencer mentioned last time. First, an allegedly mentally ill person should have to consent to have that investigation done. If he doesn't want somebody going talking to his neighbors about whether or not he's mentally ill, he should be able to stop that. The Second Amendment requires that a person be able to, given the opportunity to appear voluntarily at the hearing, and thirdly, the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, which was approved by the committee at its hearing, but was taken out by the Attorney General's office for, I'm not sure why.
Where is that, Charlie, beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, it should be inserted on page 8, line 31, answer ill.
Did Do you have other suggested amendments?
Well, the first one would be on page 3, line 27. After the period, insert if the allegedly mentally ill person consents. Where, Charlie? Page 3, line 27. Yes. If the allegedly mentally ill person consents, the investigation should also, if possible, include an interview.
Isn't that kind of awkward language, allegedly mentally ill?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the language that's used throughout the bill.
Well, then it's awkward throughout the bill.
Well, maybe it's a better word that could be used. And the Second Amendment that passed out was
person who was alleged to be mentally ill.
Make it clear that on page 4, line 5, that after the period, insert the sentence, the person shall be given the opportunity to appear voluntarily at the hearing, unless he fails to appear, unless he is detained pursuant to subsection 5 of the section of emergency. And I think it's the intent of the Mental Health Division that people be given that opportunity, but I'm not sure it's clear in the bill.
You favor the bill.
We favor the bill very much, yes.
Questions?
Were there any other... You were here the other day when we had a hearing, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Were there any other suggested changes besides what you mentioned?
Well, there are some changes with regard to that pre-hearing investigation that Ted Spencer spoke about. And the Mental Health Division has worked out some amendments that I think will solve them. I'm not sure they've completed them yet, but they've worked on them, and I think that will solve any problem with that being introduced in evidence.
Any questions of Mr. Williams?
I'm with you on that. I'm against smoking in committee.
You're against smoking?
Yeah, and I'm very conscious of your restraint. Last meeting.
That's his name. Okay, I guess there are no questions. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Mrs. Remington?
Madam Chairman, would it be possible for us to be able to hear any better?
We'll try to get people to speak up a little bit. Let's close that door and see if we're getting the typing noise out.
If you speak into that, it'll help, won't it?
Is that curious? Yeah, if you'll sit on the other side there.
No. I've served 4 sessions, and I've never yet stood up under the order of remonstrance. And you're blackening the Burns name by remonstrating so much.
Remington? Yes, I'm Phoebe Remington, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, and I'm here today to give the testimony prepared by Myron Katz, who is chairperson of our task force on involuntary mental commitment and who served on the statewide task force that prepared the legislation. He was here at the last hearing, but did not make it on the agenda, and he's in Washington, D.C., but asked me to present this testimony. For several years now, the American Civil Liberties Union, nationally and here in Oregon, has been debating the substantive and procedural questions concerning involuntary commitment for mental illness. On the substantive side, much of the discussion has centered on the issue of whether involuntary confinement for mental illness is ever justifiable. And if justifiable, under what circumstances and upon what criteria. There is growing concern among civil libertarians as to the propriety of denying liberty to any person on the prospective and speculative grounds that it is possible he may do injury to himself or others. Many civil libertarians believe that just as no person should be arrested and jailed on the grounds that it's conceivable he might in the future commit a crime, so too a person should not be preventatively detained on the speculative grounds that he's mentally ill and might become a danger to himself or to others. Our concern is further intensified by the admittedly poor track record of behavioral scientists and others in trying to accurately forecast human conduct. There have been many instances, well documented,
where erratic, eccentric, and quaint deportment has resulted in a person being committed against his will, probably because he's more of a nuisance than a threat. But even if a person is a threat, it is difficult to see why he should have his liberty taken away when he has not committed a crime, and when similar preventive detention against potential criminals, even the most dangerous, is abhorred as a clear-cut infringement on civil liberties. It is denying liberty to people against their wishes, ostensibly for their own good, that causes much concern among civil libertarians. Unfortunately, these substantive issues are not yet fully resolved, and the discussion in civil liberties circles continues. This is not so with respect to procedural questions. The procedures that must be afforded a person in connection with the state's initial efforts to involuntarily commit that person to a mental institution, and the subsequent decision to retain that person there are no longer a matter of serious dispute, as state and federal courts are making abundantly clear almost every day. Senate Bill 510, the product of the task force established by the Oregon Mental Health Division on which the ACLU participated, deals almost exclusively with these procedural rights. Whether or not a person who has not committed a crime should ever be involuntarily committed to an institution for the mentally ill, the fact is that all states, including Oregon, continue to do so on the ground that such persons are mentally ill, are pose a danger to themselves or others, or in need of treatment, care, or custody, or on some other criteria. That being the case, it is of the utmost importance that whenever an involuntary commitment procedure is undertaken, there's proper respect for an allegedly mentally ill person's rights, including that person's rights once confined and following treatment. On this, virtually all civil libertarians, and we're pleased to note, most courts of law agree. Although the ACLU of Oregon does not endorse the proposition implicit in Senate Bill 510 that involuntary commitment is necessarily proper, we do endorse the proposition that due process should be observed under all circumstances. In this respect, we believe that Senate Bill 10, while it may not go as far as we would like it to go, is a good bill and should pass. There is one amendment that we propose, which Mr. Williamson mentioned, and that is to reinstate the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which the entire task force recommended and was, I understand, inadvertently dropped out in the Attorney General's office. And he has included on this the amendment that he would offer on this. He has attached to this statement his summary of 12 points that he calls key features of this new involuntary mental commitment law.
Thank you. Questions of Mrs. Remington? Thank you, Mrs. Remington. Ruth Shepherd? I'm sorry, Ruth. I forgot Representative Peck was here.
That's all right. I am.
All right.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. We'll put you right on, Bracey.
Well, if Representative Peck is willing, I appreciate that honor. My name is Ruth Shepherd. I testify on my own behalf with permission of the leadership of the Committee on Aging, which I do serve as a staff member. And I am here with some experiences having to do with the elderly population and the impact that 510 may or may not have on it. As a rule, those of us in the advocacy role for seniors would support this bill with a few reservations, and those are the points that I'd like to make this afternoon. Some of the experiences that I've had and others that have accumulated this report for you include having listened to commitment proceedings for senior citizens, and listen to the physician judge's discussions in regard to those commitments over a period of a couple of years, and some involvements with general planning for aging programs and an awareness of the alternatives and the deficits that aren't available. As you know, 1 out of 10 of us are seniors, 65 and over. And according to the
pardon?
Depends on the level where you draw the line, Senator White, and sometimes there's a whole lot more on some days than others.
It's not the age, Ruth, it's the mileage.
You're right, Senator Burns.
They program on aging reports of 1970 do point out that we're talking about very few people in terms of those that actually are committed, voluntarily or otherwise. And we have diminished since 1970 that population by quite a bit. At that time, Damage had 49, Oregon State Hospital had 232, and Eastern Oregon Hospital had 131. The thing we'd really like to bring out today is that it's possible that none of these referrals were actually necessary, and that they must be seen in the light of the great need for alternative services. Now, we know that the division has presented this report and the bill in the context of the need for an alternative care plan. It's the point of view of seniors that alternative services planned at the community level all too often neglect the senior component, and we claim that, for instance, in welfare last biennium, only $30,000 was spent on home care services, which might have $30,000 that might have precluded institutional care for, had we, you know, we're relating these things, had we been able to increase that amount. Only 99 persons over 65 years old in the last biennium were recorded as having been involved with the division's treatment program at any point in the state.
You'll have to, Madam Chairman, she'll have to translate that figure. I don't understand it.
Only 99 persons appeared in community mental health centers and or for treatments that the state provides within the division services that were 65 and over.
Voluntarily, of course.
Right, on that score. And if that would be an additional figure to those that were committed to the hospital. Although older people constitute 10% of the population, nationally they account for 25% of the mental hospital admissions. And this statistic doesn't demonstrate...
Just a minute, Mr. Shepard.
I want to back up a minute.
Senator
Keith
Burns.
When you were talking about the number of people in the institutions, were you referring to only the number that are over 65?
Right. That has diminished, Senator Burns, by a good deal, but...
You know why it's diminished,
don't you? Yeah, I'd like to address that in a little bit. Okay.
I know why, too.
Would you give me the last two sentences of your statement over again?
Although older people constitute 10% of the population, they account for 25% of the mental hospital admissions nationally. This statistic doesn't demonstrate the elderly's incidence of mental illness, but the inadequacy of the outpatient care. And that would be the point we want to make. There are a lot of reasons why... commitments are made unnecessarily. One of the major ones is a lack of awareness of alternatives that are available, part of the private pay patient and the private physician. There often are, for instance, nursing home beds and or foster care beds that are available in the community, but that are not seen by either the judge or the physician or a complex of both as a viable alternative.
Senator Keith Burns.
But most of those do not really fulfill the needs of the person that ends up in a mental institution who otherwise could remain at home. In other words, those are not a good in-between. The home care works, okay. And the alternative often is the mental institution and not the nursing home, the rest home, and so on.
Insofar as nursing home care is a good alternative, and that the discharge is now from the state hospital to the nursing home, I would say that nursing home is a very defensible alternative for many of them. And for some of those, if you go back to the other way, 16% possibly of nursing home patients don't belong there at all anymore. They belong at home if we had alternative care and could rip off that money to go that route. We know, too, that there's an unevenness of alternative care services now in the state, and that in the Portland area, it's virtually the only place where, if you were going to make a turnaround on this procedure, you really had some choices for senior citizens that were underbedded in homes for the able in Lane County and so forth. I sense that the committee is well aware of this. I think what we'd like to do is to be able to support the bill, but give a heavy shot for the fact that the state government still has not addressed itself specifically to alternative patterns for seniors. As you may know, the most common problem is depression, and those symptoms are loss of interest or poor appetite and an attitude of hopelessness, often personal neglect. Time and again, we've seen the commitment based, we think, on a combination of perceptions of the welfare worker and the physician or the judge, or a bunch of them together, it would appear that a rather eccentric lifestyle is the condition to which they're addressing themselves rather than the actual need for custodial care or institutionalization. The suicide rate among men climbs steadily with age until it reaches 59 per 1,000 at the age of 85, compared to an average for men of all ages of 16% per 1,000. Persistent or severe depression isn't natural, even in older people who are physically ill. And the treatment is usually effective, especially if it's not early. And so,
Senator Smith.
Hang on a minute. You and I have examples of eccentric lifestyle.
Yes. Yeah. Many of them are called to mind. One hearing, for instance, a woman on welfare, 75 or 80, in pretty good physical health, had lived in her little house for a good number of years and had been visited once in a while by a welfare worker. A son and his bride from Southern California.
She was committed?
Yeah, we watched the proceedings on this, and she typifies it. A son and his...
Why was she committed?
Because there was pressure, for one thing, to obtain the use of that house on the part of the son. But in addition to that, she lived with all the blinds down and only shot off to the grocery store about once every 10 days, and her house was a hovel. One couldn't see any organizational pattern. There were a whole lot of dabs of food in the refrigerator constantly, and the welfare worker continuously wrung her hands that this woman really couldn't shape up and get herself tidy.
The court was not aware that there were pressures on the use of the house?
The court was aware, but the woman came to the court that morning at 8 o'clock in a completely bewildered condition, not really knowing why she was there. Probably pretty sensitized and confused by the experience, and couldn't tell the judge how old she was or where she was born, and a few other selected questions of that nature, which can affect and make definitions of mental illness. Plus the fact that... The question of care was brought up by another caseworker who was there, who said that she wondered if it wouldn't have been nice a few years ago if they could have gone in with a housekeeper and cleaned her up once a week and gotten the show on the road by having somebody let her know that somebody cared.
We used to have a whole lot of people like that in my hometown. They come out at night and take stuff out of the garbage cans around the stores, and they lived, and nobody bothered them, and they never bothered anybody. And things just worked out great. See, we need more small towns.
As long as they're accommodating, Senator Burns, right. That's one of our concerns. We realize that we're talking about a very small percentage of senior citizens, but we have also the concept that about 14% of senior citizens are within a framework that we call at risk. That is to say that they have growing dependencies, such as the need for a little custodial care, a little bit of supervision, and a few protective services and minor home services.
Senator Keith Burns.
What most of the cases I see is, I think, the description you had of this person fits it. I think the senility, the paranoia, the company system, and lack of memory and recall, and they don't care very much about taking care of themselves, but they aren't of any harm to themselves, they aren't any harm to anybody else. But once a week isn't a good job.
Oh, again, it wouldn't be an either or kind of thing. It may well be, for instance,
really a daily thing.
Yeah. The alternative care is, you know, as our committee is seeing them, is not an either or kind of thing, Senator Burns. It is on a continuum in which there are responses to the functional disorder no matter where you are on it. And one of the most outstanding and challenging, hopeful kinds of things is the possibility that you could cluster a group of people in a neighborhood in foster care settings with daycare as the center of point for nutrition and socializing and everything else. we haven't learned to put our hand yet administratively on how you do that.
Well, I mean,
Senator Keith Burns.
You're talking about something that's an alternative to commitment, an alternative to nursing homes and nursing homes, right?
It's primarily an alternative to state institutionalization at this point, so far as this bill is concerned. And in that regard, nursing homes are an alternative.
I don't think they're an alternative to the case that you're talking about, because maybe I haven't had enough experience, but I would
Go ahead, Ms. Chow.
Well, I would only like to conclude by supporting the bill, but making a heavy emphasis on the possibility that the alternatives that are spoken about here maybe don't really exist in enough numbers for seniors to make
questions.
A reality.
Questions of Ms. Shepard. Senator Smith.
Then I assume what you're saying is that the examples which you described would have been committed under this bill as it is under existing law. You think there ought to be another way? Is that what you're saying?
No, I would say that the example that I described, given the intent of this bill as I read it, is the person would not have been committed, but would have been directed towards some kind of alternative care. It might have been nursing or a nursing home, or it might have been some other.
What part of the bill would that take place?
If I understand the intent of the bill, it is to give authority for us. It doesn't make stringent and binding the need to commit to the hospital. Am I not understanding correctly? Doesn't it give a choice?
Well, I just don't know where that is.
Well, if that's not the case, then we would certainly like to make that potential.
Hey, Charlie, it seems to me this is an alternative method of commitment.
Charlie, you know.
Well, I think there would be two places to go. At least that first is the pre-hearing investigation.
What page?
Which is required on page 3 of lines 15 through 19. So before anything ever got into the commitment process, you'd have a person going out that could make an evaluation and see what other sort of resources would be available to this person prior to going through any sort of court hearing and state institutionalization. And this has been successful in Multnomah County, where it's already operating. And then,
well, Madam Chairman, as I read
Senator Smith.
Sorry, 15 and 19, this primarily provides that the community health program director makes a determination as to probable cause for just the question of the court commitment. Well, it's another person's individual decision.
That's correct, but they also talk to the person and determine what sorts of things they might do.
What's your second reference, Charlie?
Page 8 and 9, line 27 through 34 on page 8 and top of page 9. Now, some of that's already in existing law, but this would require that you can only commit a person when it's the last workable alternative and if resources aren't available for their care in the community.
We understood it to be a
Hi, I think your position is clear. Are there further questions of Mrs. Shepherd? Thank you, Mrs. Shepherd. Representative Peck.
No,
you're not going to bribe us with candy this time, Grace.
Well, a candy chair? No, I never met it as a bribe. You better go to confession for accusing me of that.
Can I go? Can I go to you? You hear my
Can I love to hear you.
Would you take witnesses? I like that.
Madam Chairman, I'm Grace Oliveira Peck. My name is Thomas Bill. I'm not going into a lot of details about the bill or give you a lot of facts and figures. I'll just tell you why I was glad to be one of the proponents of this bill. The reason I came to the legislature in 1949 was to try to change the commitment law they had at that time. And I tried to get some others who were going to be candidates to do something about it, and I couldn't be sure they were, so I filed at the last minute and came down to try to do that. I did this because I had visited the state hospital and seen some of the people there I didn't think should be there. And I had a neighbor I was very fond of as well, and I knew her from the time I was a little kid, and she was confined down there, and I didn't think she should be there. That time there were a group of people who were advocating jury trials for the mentally ill, and I thought this was wrong to subject these people to sitting in front of the jury and all. And my dad had to have a very serious nervous breakdown at one time, and I knew that if he ever had to go through such a thing as that, he'd have never gotten home, because after he'd have left, he was that upset at the time that I'm afraid he would have maybe committed suicide or something. So I was upset against the jury trial. Well, I was able that first session, with the help of Representative Geddes from Roseburg, to change so that two people had to sign the application, and that in Multnomah County they were summoned from the district attorney's office was to sit in. They felt it was that important for divorces and all that sure should be for these people. And a few other changes, but I followed this through quite a bit. I have spent 3 days of time on several occasions in the Eastern Oregon State Hospital before and since. They have the retarded over there too. I went over there to check into complaints, and I wandered around at night, listened to doors and things like this to hear if some of the treatment I heard they were giving was true. And I haven't stayed overnight at the state hospital or Damish or the other institutions, but I have visited them frequently. At this session, I've been attending Mass practically every Sunday at 1 o'clock at the state hospital, and then I visit around here and there and talk to people. And so I think I understand the sort of the pulse of these state institutions. I supported this bill because although there have been changes in the commitment law since 1949, my first session, I feel there's still a lot of changes due, and I thought that this bill was an attempt to do this, to make things better for these people. You want to remember, now Ms. Shepherd spoke about putting them in nursing homes and putting them in the homes for the aged. In 1949, and for many years after, until I think it was maybe 61 or so, I don't remember that session, we didn't have a way of taking people from the state hospital or mentally ill people, mentally sick people of any kind, and putting them in nursing homes and homes for the aged. We put money, we appropriated money one of those sessions to do this. I think we started out with $437,000. And this was to let people, or give people in the state hospital and the homes a chance to go into back to their own homes, apartments, or to live with some of their people, and also to go to send those that needed the care into nursing homes and homes for the aged so that they just didn't have to die in the state hospital if they didn't need to be there. They'd gotten help there, some of them to the extent that they could do these things, although they were not well enough, really, to go out just absolutely on their own. They didn't have money. We had to provide their welfare system for them for a long time. It was looking at the Department of Health to do this, and they didn't have the money, and the welfare department, so they didn't have it in their budget, so we finally set up this money and put it in the welfare department to see if they did it. At the beginning, the administrator didn't like it at all and wasn't too happy with it, even the second session in their budget request, but it was put in nevertheless, and they were given this job. Now it's just considered something. The fact that they're talking and phasing the state hospital down here out in from 2 to 4 or 5 years is indicative that there are fewer people out there. We are doing something for them, and they are getting out into the community. It is necessary at times to bring people in there because there are some people who never will be able to go into these facilities. We'll have to build some new ones at additions, maybe at Damage or somewhere to take care of the few hundred people that might be left to require this care or might come in. It isn't because that they do crimes. There are people out there, of course, who are there because they were considered criminally insane or something like this. In the old days, they were put over there, and even now, someone puts in a defense of put me in the mental hospital. I did wrong, but I did it because, you know, I wasn't well. Just recently, a boy I have helped several times to try to keep my others back in there, and he supposed to have made the cry, according to the papers. Nobody's tried to help me. Why don't you put me in a mental institution instead of the penitentiary? Well, we have some of those people there. But these people are there. It's not only that they're a threat to themselves with things that they do. They are a threat in some instances to other people. But when you see people out there who have, and you see them in nursing homes, who have to have mittens and all on to protect them from harming themselves, other sort of things like this, these people are sick and need some care, and the state is responsible for this. But certainly, I don't want to see one person die in the state institution who shouldn't be there, not only for themselves, but also for their families. Because many, at the time that I was fighting for a change in this, as it was in the beginning, maybe a poor comparison, but you know I'm kind of used to those. I mean, you're used to hearing them from me. But I had seen a couple of examinations that I'd been asked to sign references for people in some pretty high positions, you know. And one of the questions, have you ever, any member of your family ever been in a mental institution? and this was a mark against them if they had to say so. And I thought it's a shame that some of these poor old grandparents of some of these young people were there. They hadn't really done anything wrong. They had just somewhere along the road, they had gotten off the balance. They were a little mentally sick. They need a little help. But there's no reason they had to stay there till they died. So if they could go out to these other institutions, it made quite a bit of difference. I have sat in perhaps as many hearings in Multnomah County Court for mentally people as any legislator here. I started doing this after 49. I kept it off. Judge Dixon was there, and he invited me up. In those days, we had a little room downstairs where we could keep them temporarily while they were waiting hearing. Then we went out to the Morningside Hospital, and now we have this crisis ward up in the medical school. I'm fighting to keep the priority on up there for at least the metropolitan area. They have 11 beds up there where people go and wait their hearing. Some of those people go home without having to have the hearing. They give them some kind of care, and whatever's wrong with them proves that it comes out. They come out all right. They go back home with their family. Some have to stay and have a hearing. The last time I appeared before Judge Dixon, or I went up there in one particular case, this girl had said she knew me and get a hold of Grace Fett. She'll tell you I'm not mentally sick. She's not an old woman either. And so they called me and thought I might be interested. So I went up there and I sat in the back and I didn't know the poor soul, you know. And finally they asked her if she was a friend of Grace Peck. She said, I sure am, you know. She knows I'm not insane, she said. So they asked if she saw me around. And she looked around, looked right through me, you know. And she said, if anyone's here says she's Grace Peck, she's an imposter. And of course she was sick enough and she came down here. But the thing I'm getting out was the compassion that Judge Dixon had when he talked to these people. And I can't imagine anyone being sent down here who didn't need to be in recent years, for sure. Because the compassion, the way he talked, the way he told them to now listen, just take it easy and just talk to us like you would talk to someone at home you loved or something, and let's hear your story. And then the young fellow there representing the defender, the public defender, is out of this world. He's a young Judge Dixon and any other judge who really has compassion. The way I was so interested that I hadn't been there when he'd never been there before, that I went back to hear the hearing the next day of a young black woman whose husband was in the service. She had some children at home, and there were not any vacant beds at the crisis ward, so they had to find a place for her that night, which they did, till her husband came in from camp, and then he made the arrangement. She went into a government facility of some sort. But the way he talked to her and the way I stayed then, I kind of got the fever. And I kept going back because I liked to see the way he worked. And I knew that it was last week that I would be able to see Judge Dixon in action. And at any rate, the way he would turn, these people would turn to this young defendant and ask whether they should, you know, should they answer this question like this. They didn't know what to do. And he'd nod or say some little something to them. There was so much real feeling about these people that I couldn't help but think what a long, long way we've come since 1949. And I bring this up because I think good things have come into being for these people since then. And while certainly we have to do a lot more, and of course everyone you meet out at the state hospital can talk at all to will tell you they shouldn't be there, or you know they've got some reason. But I think that this bill is a real big step toward correcting anything that may be wrong. I have not been here to hear the amendments that have been proposed, but in your wisdom, I know you'll decide whether or not they're good amendments. But I think the bill in itself, the heart of this bill, is real good, and I'm proud of having the name on it.
Thank you, Representative Peck. Questions of Representative Peck? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Sister Mitnick?
That's the young man I say here.
Yep, he's beaming right behind you.
When we start to vote, I'll move over there. I have more of an influence on you than I do on Ivers.
Mitnick, will you state your name for the record, please?
Jeffrey Mutnick. I'm with the public defender.
You just got a character reference.
We won't hold that against you.
I prepared a statement, but prior to that, I thought maybe I would tell you how we ran our project in Multnomah County. What we did was sign a contract with Multnomah County to provide representation for all indigent persons in involuntary commitment proceedings who had no lawyer of their own, and this was the result of the Coleman decision that Legal Aid pursued in April.
The result of the what decision?
State versus Coleman.
C-O-L-M-A-N.
C-O-L-L-M-A-N, requiring counsel in all involuntary commitment cases. And we signed a contract with the county that enabled the county to have us represent all persons who were without an attorney. The normal criminal question of whether or not the person had property was senseless in most cases. It was simply a question of whether or not they had a lawyer. The packet that we handed out is a copy of all the statistics that we accumulated during a six-month period. There's a six-month cumulative report. There are six monthly reports, and the six monthly reports contain copies of the alternative work that we did. For, in effect, the county got two people for the price of one. I acted as the attorney, and we also employed an alternative worker, Ms. Janet Casemeyer, and her function was to come into the hearings in the morning with me and interview the individual and seek an alternative that we could present to the court. So it was all done on a relatively hasty basis, but we found it to be extremely productive. We were able to place people in private hospitals. We were able to place people in nursing homes. And our job was really one of a liaison. We just acted as an intermediary. We would call the hospital and find out whether they had a place, a bed, and if they did, whether they would take a welfare patient. And if they could, then perhaps we would seek a parole for the individual to a responsible member of their family, or in many cases to myself or Mr. Casemeyer. All this had to be done in about 15 or 20 minutes, which made things sort of rough, which is why the new 24-hour notice requirement would really be beneficial. In any case, I just wanted to provide a little background on what we did. I have some statements about the bill itself. As director of the Civil Commitment Project for the Public Defender during the period of October 1st, 1972 to March 31st, 1973, I represented 200...
I think the people in back are finding it hard to hear you.
I'm sorry. I represented 227 indigent persons during the six-month period, approximately 35 persons a month. Although there are certain procedural questions remaining to be resolved by this committee in regard to Senate Bill 510, we would energetically support the following substantive provisions for the reasons given. The concept of pre-commitment screening, as embodied in Sections 1, 2, and 3 of the proposed bill, will have the effect of limiting the number of commitment hearings and will aid those persons seeking help for their loved ones to come into contact with the resources of the community mental health clinic. There is a statistic on the six-month cumulative survey that we included in this packet that states that 63 cases were screened in an experimental project in Multnomah County, and only 15 eventually required commitment hearings. One of the problems we found was that people had heard that there was this thing called a commitment hearing, and you'll note from the socioeconomic statistics that most of these people didn't really have the wherewithal to seek out the mental health clinic. And as a consequence, they came directly to the court. By referring them first to the mental health clinic, a lot of the people found that their problems weren't as serious as they thought they were, and they were able to get them squared away before they had to come to court, and a lot of the hearings were dispensed with. It's also important that individuals be given a right to periodic review to enable the committed person to participate in his own therapy and work towards a designated date of possible release. This should add little or no additional burden to the hospital in that we have found that the average length of stay for the 112 persons committed whom we represented was 41 days. Also, it is our position that 14th Amendment due process requires periodic review of persons involuntarily committed. This same rationale would apply to our support of Section 14 of the Senate Bill 510, the privilege of becoming a voluntary patient. We would also vigorously support Section 9 of the Senate Bill 510 relating to confidentiality of information and would urge that this committee strengthen this section to require consent of the patient to allow any information relating to...
What section, please?
Section 9. As it presently stands, my understanding is that this information could be used by the doctors and by the court to determine whether or not the individual is mentally ill. It's my feeling that we should require the consent of the individual before using any of that information. I don't think that it would provide any additional burden for the court.
Seven.
I don't think that it would provide any additional problem in eventually committing an individual if that was what... if that was the necessary...
Well, instead of without the consent, I don't understand. You say...
you refer back to... section, page 4, section 4, line 12, states that the report shall be made available to the examining physician or other qualified persons that may be recommended by the division. And it's my feeling that the examining physician shouldn't have the report without the consent of the individual. I think it's primarily a procedural and a procedural problem in this case, and it seems to be somewhat of an ambiguity in the drafting of the bill, in my opinion.
Questions of Mr.
Mitchell? Well, I have one or two things to make,
right.
That's all right. I have a few recommendations, and then I'll skip the rest. I'd offer the following suggestions for consideration by this committee. That the standard to be applied in determining whether or not an individual should be committed should be whether or not he is dangerous to himself or other people beyond a reasonable doubt, as evidenced by a recent overt act. There was a recent Wisconsin three-judge federal district court decision called Lessard versus Schmidt, where the court held...
Where the court said...
It's as yet unpublished. It should be published in this month's Federal Reporter. The court stated in that decision that in requiring this standard, and I quote, the fact is that if a sociologist predicted that a person was 80% likely to commit a felonious act, no law would permit his confinement. The Supreme Court in Humphrey versus Cady, C-A-D-Y, 405 U.S. 504, at page 509, and dicta stated that implicit in this definition of requiring a person to be dangerous to himself or other people is that the person has the potential for doing harm to himself or others that is great enough to justify a massive curtailment of liberty. The only standard great enough to justify this massive curtailment of liberty is dangerous to himself or other persons beyond a reasonable doubt, as evidenced by a recent overt act, and that's what the... Federal District Court in Wisconsin held.
Well, Madam Chairman, may I...
Senator Smith?
Then on page 12, lines 25 to 27, you would restore the language.
I was referring primarily to page 2 in the definition, where defines mentally ill person means a person who, because of a mental disorder, is either dangerous to himself or others beyond a reasonable doubt, as evidenced by a recent overt act, as a basic standard for commitment.
You mean limiting it to that?
No. Unable to provide for his basic personal needs and is not receiving such care as necessary for his health or safety, in my personal opinion, conflicts with the previous standard. I think that in the cases that I've handled, I've seen cases where the physicians were touched by the situation emotionally and although the person may not have been dangerous per se, could be arguably dangerous in that he wasn't eating, he wasn't sleeping, and that eventually his physical condition would deteriorate.
And they sent him to the state hospital.
That's correct.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Keith Burns.
Really, when we go back to things that Stuart Shepherd talked about, when you mentioned this, what we're saying is we don't now have the resources to take care of people that fall in that category. And so in lieu of those resources, we're putting in mental institutions.
It's my feeling that the resources are available.
Sure.
We managed to place quite a few people in nursing homes and in structured living situations. And since about the middle of November, whenever we would get a case that was ineffective geriatric case, somebody over the age of 65, we made an attempt to postpone those hearings up to 72 hours to seek any possible alternative to commitment, because it's been our feeling and we found that stabilization of individuals on medication who are over the age of 65 is not all that difficult, and in an intensive situation can be done rather quickly. One of the problems is that the nursing homes don't have the facilities to stabilize the individual because they have a doctor that comes out once a month.
Chairman.
Keith Burns.
Well, that's really part of the reason they send them to the mental institution is to stabilize them and then place them in a nursing home. Is that correct?
That's the argument.
Well, in fact, that happens a lot of times.
It does happen, but in fact, it's an extra step in the process, in my opinion.
That's the reason why they have to do that, because they don't have the facilities to do it otherwise.
Because the situation wasn't caught early enough sometimes. Pre-commitment screening might eliminate that.
Senator Irish.
Senator
John Burns.
Well, it seems, when you're talking about that, though, you're talking about something other than what is in subparagraph B. You're talking about a person who's probably seen a lot of paranoia and various other things. You're not just talking about what can be.
Well,
because otherwise you wouldn't be talking about medications to stabilize them and so forth.
Well, that's not really the case. The situation referred to in B, my understanding of that is that it's a person who is more like the person who comes out at night and ravages through the garbage can because he hasn't gone to the grocery store or goes to the grocery store and buys 50 cans of tomatoes without a can opener. And in effect, that person is unable to provide for his basic personal needs if you stretch this definition.
Let me ask a couple of questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Senator John Burns.
Are you handling them in Washington and Clackamas as well? As
we're going to start handling them in Washington in July or August.
Okay, now, as far as in the old days when I was in the DA's office, they used to commit them for being drunk or alcoholic. That practice is absolutely stopped, hasn't it?
Unless there's some organic functional disorder.
And of course, one of the problems in the old days was the fact that there was a feeling on the part of some that they perhaps get better. The geriatric cases might get better treatment at Amish than they would in some of the nursing homes.
Right.
All right, now maybe that's changed, but I was interested to hear you say that you thought that the resources were there, because I think, you know, I think they are too, but particularly what I'm interested in is your assessment of the capacity of the crisis unit. Do you think that it's overtaxed and that we need more beds up there? Can you speak to that? How have you been running into situations where you've been referring, or before the court's been sending people up to the crisis unit for a period of stay probation and there aren't any beds?
That's been a problem.
Is it a continual problem?
It's a continual problem.
What's your assessment of the additional capacity that we need up there? Because I think they do a terrific job. Could it easily be doubled?
I think it could easily be doubled.
Well, would you come down to the Ways and Means Committee when the testimony is going to be heard down there on that budget and ask to testify? I mean, because, you know, typically we hear from the people in the mental health division and others who might not have the same perspective or the same objectivity that somebody like you have. And I think it would help the committee, really. Stop down on the first floor of the Ways and Means Committee office and find out when that budget is going to be heard, and then Henning will let you off for an afternoon and come back down. Would you do that?
Sure. Okay. We've been real fortunate in that we've been able to work with the crisis unit. They call us the day before and tell us what the court hold cases are about and what their assessment is of the situation, and that's been a real fortunate thing for us. I have one other point that I'd like to make, because I'm currently involved in a lawsuit in this area, and I think that this committee could save us all a lot of trouble if they just included this in the bill. I'd urge this committee to consider an amendment granting to an indigent individual involuntarily committed an appeal which is free, without filing fees, entitled to a free attorney, entitled to a free transcript, and a waiver of bond. The court in State versus Coleman stated that there is a right to an appeal, but the civil, since this is a civil proceeding and not a criminal proceeding, it's impossible for an indigent individual to pursue this appeal. I don't think that many of them want to, but if they do, they can't, because they can't come up with a $25 filing fee. They can't get an attorney. They can't afford to have the transcript typed up. A criminal would have all those rights.
Do you appeal any of them?
I'm not permitted by our contract to appeal. In fact, I'm going to appeal one for the purpose of securing the right of an appeal. But there are a few that I might have appealed had I had the resources to do so.
Senator Keith Burns.
What is it, 24 hours they hold up the crisis unit?
They can hold them up there up to 96 hours.
Okay. Now, is that sufficient time to stabilize a person so they can go into a nursing home?
I think it is. I'm not a physician.
Well, I know that, but you've had cases up there. The thing I'm trying to reach out is this, that nursing homes, while once a person is stabilized and they got the medication there, they can take care of them, and because after all, you can't have the whole nursing home turn clear around and take care of one person. They got 90 or 150 other people, and that's the problem with why most people die in hospitals today and don't die in their homes and various other things. People, our whole life has changed. But nursing homes, in many, many of these cases, the type of case we've been talking about here today, are reluctant to take patients that arrive in that condition. And so that's why I say that we don't have the resources to take care of them the way it is now. Many of those people could also be taking care of their homes with enough daycare for them.
Senator Ivers.
Well, just commenting on what one of the reasons, of course, is not because they don't want to and that they're not stabilized, but they just don't stay stabilized all the time. And then it's the problem of getting them back when you have to go through so much red tape to try to get them back to the facility where they were released from. If the policies have changed where the operator could say this patient has now changed enough that he needs to go back for a more intensive treatment and get him back in there without a lot of red tape.
Well, they can do that.
You try and do it.
Oh, well, let me just explain what you can do. That the person that they're released to can sign a warrant. Can sign a warrant and have a policeman come up and pick them up and take them back out of the institution. That's in our present law.
Well,
if you want to find something that has no due process to it, look at that.
I have this experience all the time, Keith, and I know that it's not as easy. Law may say they can do it, but when they tell you we have no place to put them, we have no bed, we won't send anybody to get them, or this or that, you can't get them back.
You're talking about the lack of facilities. I mean,
well,
as far as
excuse
to
give
the process, though.
Senator Smith.
On page 9, lines 33 and 34, an attorney provided at no cost if he's unable to afford an attorney. Shouldn't we be identifying the indigent in that situation rather than that language, or is that similar in language here to indigent?
I think it's supposed to be similar language to indigent. We were appointed, well, there's statistics, and in the packet that we handed out about the number of employed individuals that we represented. We represented about 90% of all the people that went through the commitment hearings in Multnomah County, and only out of 227, 51 of them had worked recently.
Well, I'm not arguing.
Well, I was going to come to that. Most of the time, people are either unable to state that they wish an attorney, unable to state who their attorney would be, were they able to afford one, or unable to answer the questions about their financial means. So, if you did stipulate that it were an indigent, it would be difficult to, if you held strictly to the guidelines as we do in the criminal courts, it would be difficult for a lot of these people to have a lawyer.
Did you put drunks in the crisis unit?
I have.
Are you familiar with the facilities in Lane County, the Johnson unit?
I've never been there. I've heard good things about it. The only time I've ever sent a drunk to the crisis unit is when he was picked up at 10 o'clock at night. I'm supposed to represent him at 8 o'clock in the morning and he's still hungover.
Then there's none.
Well, then that's why you continue to use language unable to afford through the whole sale regarding positions and other qualified people.
I know
that they're automatic, then, is what you're saying.
It's almost automatic.
Yeah. And why on page 12 strike the language in 25 and 27 still? Why was the language stricken on page 25, on page 12, lines 25 to 27?
He has a bill?
Yeah. The language he is convinced that the patient is...
Mr. Williamson, do you want to supply something to that question?
That standard for release is pretty vague. A person might argue they should get out. All the superintendent has to say that it's not in his best interest. The standard that's inserted is the same standard for commitment. He's not mentally ill anymore. He shouldn't have to be in there. So, theoretically, under the existing standard, the release language, you could have people in there that couldn't be committed. Were they to have a hearing, but
you were on the task force, weren't you, Mr. Williams?
Yes, I was.
Page 15 is line 33, subsection H. Are the words substantial rights words of art?
Please, Mr. Williams, just answer that better than
that. Substantial rights, are they identified?
Page 15, line 33.
What are substantial rights? Are they constitutional rights? What are they? Are they defined? If so, where?
They're not defined. And I don't think they're...
What means is incarceration, isn't it?
Well, I think perhaps... I would think of... Courts in other parts of the country have held that a punitive transfer, for example, from a free ward or a ward where you get relatively a large amount of freedom to a ward that's very restrictive, that in some situations like that, if it's a punitive sort of transfer, you would have a right to a hearing.
Senator
Smith. One other question, Chairman. On page 18, you are provided that no person shall be subject to electroshock therapy. Is that a medical decision? Is that a philosophical decision? Huh. Not being familiar with electroshock therapy, except by rumor, I understand it's being used to great success in some cases.
Are you able to answer, Mr. Williamson? Do you want to?
Sure.
Charlie?
A patient can be given electroshock therapy or other serious or possibly dangerous treatment if it's approved by an independent physician. It's not outlawed completely. Some of the people we've represented, and I think some of the people Mr. Munich has represented, have a real dread of this sort of treatment in the hospital. And some of the drug treatments are even more drastic than the electric treatment. So the purpose of this section was simply to make sure that it's a well-founded decision that that sort of irrevocable thing is administered.
I don't agree with that, Madam Chairman, but I'm not going to argue with it.
I think it's primarily a philosophical decision.
Did you have further comments, Mr. Munich?
No.
Further questions?
Madam Chairman,
Senator White.
To me, we're kind of loving this thing to death. I think we all have a lot of things that we would like. It would be helpful to me if the witnesses that have given us 30 days could get together the suggested amendments so that we can submit them to the mental health department to get, if there is another side of these things, get this bill on the road. We can have hearings on it tonight, I mean, and we're just going to go to sleep like I've done in the last hour. I support a bill. If we think a better bill, I want to do it.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Mutnick. We'll turn to Senate Bill 583, Sergeant Murley.
Senator Brown, I've come a long way, and I want to improve my performance. I want my doctor to listen to the tape. It won't take long.
Ms. Coffey, you did just fine, but you can only appear one time on a bill. That's
I didn't realize that fact.
Sergeant Murley.
Yes, Madam Chairman.
I would think we're in the same place. I would guess I'd say
they were back there just a minute ago. Will you state your name for the record, please?
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Sergeant Murley, Murley. Although I'm a sergeant commissioned by the Tigard Police Department for the City of Tigard, the views that I express before this committee are not necessarily those of the City of Tigard nor the Tigard Police Department, but represent my views as a police officer with 13 years of experience in traffic control and accident investigation and as a citizen. I'm going to refer to particular statistics, and due to 483610 subsection 1, I will delete the names of the individuals involved. Encompassing my testimony will be in Senate Bill 354.
We're on 583.
583. All right, Bill 583. Under the Oregon Traffic Code, 1971-1972, edition, page 248, section 91. Oregon Revised Statute 163-145, criminally negligent homicide. Under subsection 1, a person commits a crime of criminally negligent homicide when, with criminal negligence, he causes the death of another person. Subsection 2, classifies this crime as a Class C felony, which is a minimum of 5 years and or $2,500 fine. This particular statute does not encompass vehicular homicide. And it's my question as to allow three lives before a person takes a test. And I'm going to refer to page 2 of an accident report in which I was directly involved. This happened in 1966, in July 6th of 1966, on Highway 99W within the city limits of Tigard. During the issuance of a citation, the arrested party was asked about the time directly prior to the accident, and it was stated at that time that he had about 5 beers and that he had drank them at a certain establishment in Portland. The subject could not answer any further questions directly concerning the accident either before impact nor directly after. The vehicle operated by the arrested party was inspected and found the damage occurred to the right front fender and the grill area. Blood, particles of tissue were on the hood area along with glass from the vehicle. It should be stated that the arrested party did admit that he was the operator of the vehicle and no one else operated the same during the evening. Arrested was transported to Washington County Sheriff's Office by a Washington County Sheriff's deputy for a breath check on the breathalyzer. Information was received that the results of the test were 0.22%. Breathalyzer checklist was attached to the original report. He was at that time booked on a charge of DUIO for driving under the influence of an intoxicating liquor with a court time set at 10 o'clock the next morning. I checked personally at Best Kaiser Hospital where the party was, the victim was taken. He was pronounced dead on arrival at 11 p.m. by Dr. Bernardo at that time. The statement by Dr. Bernardo was that the right leg was partially severed, left leg was completely severed, massive head injury with brain tissue emitting. The party was struck and knocked a total of 132 feet from the point of impact. The offending vehicle continued on for approximately 513 more feet before he was forced to stop because of severe engine damage. Concerning the same accident, a statement of a party that was taken directly after the accident was that, quote, the car passed me at approximately 75 miles an hour at Tigard Elementary, weaving badly on two southbound lanes. I slowed down in order to avoid any possibility of collision. The second car pulled to a stop opposite the Masonic Hall. The deceased got out, closed the door. The car that passed me veered into the car and driver. The body was thrown approximately 120 feet. The car door, which was closed at the time, was torn off and thrown approximately 60 feet from the point of impact. One shoe was beside the car of the deceased. The other shoe was 70 feet from the point of impact. The deceased was dead when I reached him within 30 seconds. This statement was rendered by a medical doctor at that time. I should note to the committee that this accident was witnessed by the victim's wife, who was standing across the street waiting for her husband to come back from escorting a lady from the Masonic Hall, who they had just had an Eastern Star installation at that time, and that she witnessed the entire incident from start to finish. The arrested party was also issued a citation for driving under the influence of an intoxicating liquor, and at that time there was brought before the grand jury on a charge of negligent homicide. He was found guilty of this charge and was sentenced to 120 days in jail on a work release plan, where he reported to jail on the weekend. On the DUIL charge, he was not prosecuted. As a result, his license was still in effect and is currently driving without restriction. Now, I refer to Oregon Revised Statute 482.430, conviction of a crime as grounds for mandatory revocation or suspension. And under subsection 1, as I understand the wording of it, the word shall is a mandatory and not permissive. That the division shall revoke any person's permit or license of any of the following offenses. And under subsection A of subsection 1, manslaughter or criminally negligent homicide resulting from operation of a motor vehicle. On the 13th of this month, a driver's license check was made of the subject. There is no indication of a negligent homicide charge on the party. He is not suspended as of 4/13/73. There are no restrictions on his license at this particular time. I feel that the bill in itself stands for the increased penalty on third and subsequent convictions of negligent homicide is good, yes, but I believe that it should be amended in some manner that introduces a mandatory sentence imposed on each and every case of negligent homicide that comes before the court. rather than a permissive attitude. They're taking into consideration the party and his wife and his child. They're not taking into consideration the victim's wife and his family or any other situation that may be involved in that.
Then dismiss.
Are you saying that the division did not get his license and should have?
Yes, sir, I say that. It did have. It did not take his license and should have. And it was noted on...
Did the division respond to you or anybody?
Well, we received a teletype from the Department of Motor Vehicles indicating that they had received information on this accident on 7-7-66 at 04-17, which is 4:17 in the morning. That they indicated at that time a fatal accident had occurred. Time 10:30 p.m. Date 7-6-66, County Washington, Highway 99W and Southwest Watkins Street. The deceased, the date of birth of the deceased, the address of the deceased, and the type of the accident, which was a pedestrian vehicle.
What did the court order in the trial?
The court order of the trial?
Yeah, he was found guilty of criminal negligence.
He was found guilty of criminal negligence. Driving a vehicle and committing the crime of criminal negligent homicide. But issued in April of 67 a court order of dismissal regarding this party. And I quote, this matter now coming before the court upon motion of the district attorney of Washington County, Oregon. And appearing to the court that a citation was heretofore filed in the above entitled court, charging the defendant with the crime of driving under the influence of intoxicating liquor. It further appearing to the court that the defendant has been prosecuted on another crime in connection with this matter, therefore, in the best interests of the state of Oregon and in the furtherance of justice, said citation should be dismissed. It is therefore by the court considered and ordered that said citation be and same is hereby dismissed and any bond exonerated. The date of the death of the day is omitted, but
it what was the other April. Charge?
DUIL.
He was arrested initially for the charge of driving under the influence of an intoxicating liquor. It was subsequently then taken before the grand jury for indictment on the negligent homicide charge.
Well, if I heard you, though, the division failed to take his license under negligent homicide.
Yes, sir, that's correct. It should have, but it did not.
Or did the court order his license to be taken?
I have no idea. The only commitment that I received, or the only information on conviction, was that he received 120 days in jail, work release plan, reported to jail on weekends, ordered not to drink, or... associate with alcohol in any manner.
Senator Hoyt.
Well, Madam Chairman, I just want to make
a
point. I'd like to have the division answer this. I'd like to have a clarification.
Well, it isn't. Yeah, fine. Okay.
What they're doing today regarding that.
All right. You don't know, do you, Gil?
I think that the gentleman read the order. The court order disposed of that.
Senator, I did. It was a dismissal of the order of driving under the influence, which was another thing. It was. Yes, I will say it is a lesser and included charge. But the fact was that he was cited for driving under the influence, which brought him before the court to begin with on the negligent homicide charge.
Mr. DeWitt, get the name and call Vanita Howard at Motor Vehicles and find out what happened.
I can give them the MDR record as we received it as to the fatal accident on it and as to their number. Our case number on this particular thing was 66573.
Call the court, too, and see what the court order was. Further questions? Senator White, did you have any questions? You were going to testify on these other bills, too. Why don't you go ahead?
All right, ma'am. Under Senate Bill 354, creates presumption of intoxication if a sample of a driver's breath, blood, and urine. It directs the court not to receive evidence if the percentage of alcohol in the blood is decreasing or increasing. Recommend also that it goes before the committee and is passed on to the legislature for vote. That I have nothing contrary to say to the bill itself. concerning the Bill 563.
Are there any questions of Sergeant Merley on 354? Frank, go ahead, sir.
Under Senate Bill 563, it limits the construction by the courts of certain provisions of implied consent law. I believe that this is, as it is stated there, with the addition of licensed nurse or hospital laboratory technician may withdraw the blood or pierce human tissue, is quite as right as it stands. Under any questions
any
on
questions?
Bill 563?
Okay, go ahead.
Under Senate Bill 570, rebuttable presumption that chemical analysis under the implied consent law is accurate when performed by qualified individual and certified equipment. This I again will concur with, because this is currently being done where the men are required to go through a breathalyzer school, and the equipment is checked, and the control ampules that are utilized by the breathalyzer are currently checked by the health division and are ordered changed within a certain number of days.
Question? Go ahead.
Under Senate Bill 583, I would like to see...
No, we started
oh,
there.
I'm
we
sorry.
Should be on 352.
I'm sorry, I had that. We already had that. I'm sorry, it's Senate Bill 352, I believe it is.
Yeah.
I got more. Requires a suspension under Bill 352. Requires a suspension of certain motor vehicle driving privileges on failing to stop and render aid. Under Oregon Revised Statute 483602, page 146 of the Vehicle Code, I believe that the wording in this particular statute is overwhelmingly clear in that what the duties of the driver is under subsection 1, that it is not a permissive or discretionary action on the part of the operator involved, that the wording is mandatory, and in that I'll quote in part, that the driver of any vehicle involved in an accident which results in injury or death to any person or causes damage to a vehicle shall stop such vehicle at the scene of an accident and ellipsis and shall remain at the scene of the accident until he's fulfilled the requirements of subsection 2, which indicates that he is to give his name, address, registration number of the vehicle, exhibit, and give his number of his operator's license, and render any necessary aid to the injured. Now, the main reason that I found in my investigations for hit and runs for leaving the scene were, number one, that the operator was drunk, or, number two, the operator was suspended. Number three, there's a combination of both drunk and suspended. And number four, he had no insurance. Now, that could be a combination of all four. In my particular case, it wasn't a situation of hit and run, but it was a case of where all four were involved, where I was injured. The operator was drunk, he was suspended, and he had no insurance, and was driving a borrowed car. Oregon Revised Statute 483991, the penalties generally under subsection 12, page 160, would be considered in my reading of it an indictable misdemeanor because it provides fines from 100 to 5,000, 30 days to 1 year in a county jail and a penalty and a penitentiary of not less than one nor more than 5 years or by a fine and imprisonment. It would fall under, I believe now at this particular time, a Class A misdemeanor, Class C felony. I would recommend to the committee that it be a revocation, not a suspension for hit and run, and the enforcement of the penalties provided. As it is now, the person that is operating the motor vehicle goes before the court and is suspended for one more year. And maybe will possibly draw 30 days or 15 if he does good time. This is the way that I have seen things here in the past, and it hasn't seemingly has been changed. So if there could be some teeth put into that particular bill where it's necessary or it is mandatory that this person serves jail time or has a fine imposed upon him, it may prevent some of these parties from getting behind the wheel of the vehicle. That's the only thing that I can answer.
Questions of Sergeant Merlin. Senator Keith Burns.
Senator Hoyt, you serve on the Traffic Safety Commission?
He was chairman, that's what I thought.
But I don't understand the purpose of Senate Bill 354, of why they can't take evidence that the percentage of alcohol in blood is decreasing or increasing.
So what the decision just in the last 6 or 8 months on this?
Yeah, Schwab was the decision.
What does that have to do with it?
Well, it was related to that. The one that he wrote, they arrested him for negligent homicide and took his blood, which wasn't under the DUIL, which, and he refused consent, so they refused to admit it in evidence. I guess that really wasn't related to this.
I don't believe there was anything in reference to not admitting anything into evidence. That is the House bill that's currently.
Well, I see. That's been cut out. I see. That's been deleted. Okay. That was in the original bill. It's been cut out. Okay.
For the questions of Sergeant Merlin. Thank you, Sergeant. Marie and Myrtle Brown, are you related? Do you both want to come up together?
No, we're not related. We just happen to be neighbors.
All right. Would you like to come up?
We're all from Burns, Senator Burns District. There are four of us came down, but we kind of split up.
Burns, Senator.
Which Burns?
Huh? Oh, this one, Pete. I'm sorry. I forgot about that.
I said, oh.
That's all right. I'll answer you.
Oh, fine. Good.
Oh, hi. Most of us addressed to Bob Burns.
At Smith, Oregon.
At Smith, Oregon.
And with lots of Browns. Well, actually, this gentleman, everything he's, Sergeant Merlin, has said so much, and we have a feeling that something must be done. I mean, really, I'm testifying, not testifying particularly at A1 Bill. We were sort of shocked at this one that said that after three negligent homicides, if I get my tongue straight, you would then do something. Even with a dog, it's just one bite, you know. And I should think that after, if anybody's driving after two, this is just too bad. So.
Let's go for the death penalty.
Not the death penalty, but for heaven's sake, someplace get them out of the way of driving.
Let me ask you a question.
Senator John Burns.
Yes, I prosecuted a man once for the crime of negligent homicide. He ran a little girl on a bicycle off the road and killed her out on a southeast 122nd Avenue. And he had been convicted 15 times of drunken driving. And the punishment for the crime of negligent homicide was 3 years in the penitentiary of county jail. He got 18 months. He served 18 months after his appeal had been successful. And do you know that he's been convicted 3 or 4 times since then? Now, what would you do with a person like that?
I think, actually, there's this bill that has sort of like a parole system for the drunken driver. And I think maybe this is something you're going to have to come up with. I mean, we protect ourselves from other people that are, you know, I mean, if somebody running around shooting a gun or something of this sort that's killing people, you aren't going to let them out there. And even though it is transportation, we must have some way that we can do something about these.
With what?
I don't know. It's up to you to come up with something, I would think. Either check that puts that bill in that has something like a parole system. Surveillance. That's the one there. Something of this sort. There should be a better way than just having them out there. We're taking our chances of being run down every day in the week. And if you look at your statistics. And then on the breathalyzer, I would... Let's see. Well, back...
Well, we're over on that bill.
Senator Keith Burns.
Yes. John.
You talking to the witness?
I'm talking to John Burns. Senator John Burns. We got rid of the Habitual Criminal Act and the Senate Bill 40, did we?
Well, we have a dangerous offender provision that relates only to people that have been convicted of felonies involving use of deadly force.
Why don't we put automobile drivers that are drunk under that provision? That's a deadly force.
Maybe expand the dangerous offenders. But then you'd have to make the drunk driving a felony,
I suppose. I don't know. It seems that the goal should be, we know that we We don't know how to keep him from drinking. The goal is to keep him from having a beer.
Right.
Well, we passed in 1967 a bill that permitted the judge to impound the car. And that was implemented, I think, once in Umatilla County, once in Umatilla County. Had to drive this problem.
That bill was clean when we finally passed it, except the sheriff and the judges won't support it.
Yeah, we provided they just take the license plates off the car and take the plates in and give them to the court.
But
you did have the joint ownership problem.
This is part, we've been attending courts up in Portland, the DUIL courts, and listening in and seeing what's going on, and the judges are not, some of them are, but it's, you know, change it or something to start, and really we're not getting those people off the road at all.
Senator Keithburn.
You know, I think one of the problems, there's a couple of problems. One is the one I mentioned, and I'm going to return the license plate done. But the other thing is, if these bills we pass on drunken driving, there are those exceptional cases where a guy makes a mistake, and you know and I know, if you look at his background and everything, he doesn't understand how it happened this time, it's never going to happen again, and yet there's no place in the law to take care of him. And you see that. And this is what, in part, fouled up the procedure, I think. And I don't know what the answer is.
But there surely should be when they have a list like some of them.
Oh, I know. There's no question about those
cases. This is ridiculous that, any time you go out on the road, you are in trouble because there are those out there that,
But what's the answer?
Well, I would say that if you're taking their license or impounding their car, which I would agree with, take their license, and then anybody's caught, if they're out there driving somebody else's car, that's just test speed.
They're talking about the license plate. Taking the driver's license doesn't do any good.
No, but take their license plate, the car, like you do.
Then the police can stop them when they don't have a license plate. They know they're...
With that car,
that's right.
But if they're driving somebody else's car, this is test beans for the person that loaned it, unless they stole it, because, this would make you, if you're going to let anybody drive your car, you'd better see that they have a current driver's license. Because on your deer and this sort of thing, if you're out, what do? You take all the equipment if you shoot a deer out of the season or something of this sort, but a person, it doesn't count as much?
Well, other questions than Mrs. Brown?
Well, we did deer for the coyotes.
Yeah, this is what I mean, and it's too bad, like, this poor police sergeant, my goodness, and all these other families, we had two youngsters in this very recent time that were killed by drivers that should not have been out there. It's right in our neighborhood. And I imagine most all of you have had members of your family who are involved or will be involved just very shortly with drivers that should not be out there on the road.
Other questions? Thank you, Mrs. Brown.
Other
Mrs. Brown?
She's in the other hearing room right now.
I see. All right. Jill Bellamy?
For the record, I'm Gil Bellamy with the Oregon Traffic Safety Commission, and I'm authorized to represent the governor when certain bills are in his message. Our Senate Bill 583 is in the governor's message. It's one of the 30 bills that he believes is part of the answer to the problem. You've heard some testimony, and Senator John Burns apparently is aware of the type of people we're talking about. This bill is really nothing more nor less than a quarantine bill. Question's been asked, well, what do you do? All right, when you get down to the bottom line, there is one thing you can do. For the 7 years, the minimum 7 years that a person is in prison for the third negligent homicide conviction, he is not killing anybody. And there are some people that are so bad in Oregon who we know about that the only question is, will they kill themselves before they kill somebody else? The question is not, will they kill somebody? And I have some individuals that are in that category here. Here's a Dayton, Oregon truck driver who began his truck driving career in January 1965 and was fired for attaining drunkenness on the job. In June 1967, he got his second job. He was suspended for a period of 10 weeks, November 69, for recurrent drunkenness. He was later reinstated by the same truck firm, but then he was finally fired for attaining drunkenness on the job. He went through five situations of employment like that, truck driving in Oregon, the biggest rigs. In January 1970, the driver experimented with LSD at a truck stop at the outskirts of Portland while on the job. Concerned acquaintance said the driver called the driver's wife. She found him unconscious, took him home. He took a 12-gauge shotgun and started firing in all directions. And the wife and four kids fled. That's his work record. Now his driving record is interesting. He was cited in the aggregate of 52 times. At the time of his death, which by the way occurred in this collision, driving a 1969 Mack truck fully loaded, he had 8 warrants outstanding against him for moving traffic violations.
Why did the PUC revoke his employer's certificate of employment?
I don't know. When you've asked me that, I didn't know that they could do that. I have several truck drivers in the same similar situations. I've never heard of their employer.
Well, Madam Chairman, I would suggest that if you do, Gil, that you immediately contact the Public Utilities Commissioner and find out whether or not they can revoke the certificate of convenience that they have, and if they can't do it, then get back to this committee and we'll put a committee bill in.
DeWinner, will you get the names of those and check them?
Certainly they can revoke the certificate of convenience to the trucking firm.
Well, sure they can. Absolutely.
Well, there is one point that I wanted to make on this. I have a list of his convictions, the 52 convictions. They're all within the last 10 years, by the way. I should say within the last 5 years. Then he was doing 90 miles an hour, coasting down a 9-mile grade with the truck in neutral after consuming a fifth of brandy, and he crossed the center line, and you know the rest. But he had a valid driver's license, a valid Oregon driver's license at the time of his death. So after all of this, our present laws, we're unable to stop these people. I have another truck crash report.
Is that an Oregon case?
Yes. That's
what's
a Dayton,
the name?
Oregon man. The name of the man?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I have it here. We try to. We say things like the driver resident of Dayton, Oregon until when he was born without saying his name.
Well, will you get the name to Mr. DeWinner so he can check on?
This is an official motor carrier accident investigation report, federal. I have another one.
Do you have a question for him?
Well, I guess it was just an observation. He made it because he had a valid license. The fact of the matter is, in my estimation, whether he had one or not, he'd still be out there because we have a record of all kinds of driving without a license.
That's true. I'm just testifying on behalf of Senate Bill 583 to get some. The governor's message, of course, addresses this problem in the form of a patrol to monitor the actions of suspended drivers, much like a parole officer would, and that bill will be coming to this committee if it gets through Senate Transportation. But I have another truck crash report.
Senator Keith Burns.
Well, as I understand this bill, what you do is a person has to kill twice, is that it?
Yes.
With
negligent homicide.
You know, I don't understand that. In the first place, I don't think putting people in jail like that is a deterrent type of case. So all you're trying to do is get them out of society so they can't do it again, because apparently they can't be cured of their alcoholism or whatever problem they're suffering from. And if that's your goal, I don't know why you wait till the third time to do it.
I don't either. And I don't know why you come in with a mandatory 7-year minimum when the new code is set up in 5, 10, and 20. Why don't you just make on a second conviction for negligent homicide, they're subject to the dangerous offenders statute, which would give the judge discretion putting them in for 5 or 10 years.
Well, I have no opposition to a new approach. These bills come through a private citizen committee, then to the governor's staff, and by the time they come up to the legislature and hearings like this, I think one of the purposes is to find a better way to do what we're trying to do. These offer a point of reference. But when you're talking about judicial discretion, I have a case here I'd like to recite. I'm using an editorial from the Oregon Statesman because it hits so hard in perspective, and they ask the question, which is more valuable, the life of a deer or a man? And it says, this week, 11, a man was fined a total of $400, given 2 concurrent 30-day jail sentences, deprived of his hunting privileges, meaning he could never get a hunting license again, and his rifle was confiscated, not to be returned, for shooting 2 deer before the season started. Now, compare the sentence with the following. Larry Joe Fogarty is a 20-year-old Oregonian. He pled guilty to criminally negligent homicide in Portland. This says earlier this year. It was actually on April 14, 1972. This was his second conviction for negligent homicide in 5 years. He's only 24 years old. His driver's license was not, you know, permanently revoked. His car was not confiscated, not even impounded. He was not given a fine because he was an indigent. He was not sent to jail. He was put on probation. So the editorial, I think, made the point very well. That's why, Senator Burns, we have a mandatory sentence in the law at a certain point because, just bluntly, we don't trust that much discretion in the judiciary.
All right. Now, I'm going to say one thing, and I'm only going to say it once until we start voting on the bill. I am absolutely, totally, and have always been against mandatory minimums. If we want to impose mandatory minimums, let's reduce the judicial salaries from the $35,000 and $29,000 range that the governor wants to increase them to, make the judges clerks and pay them $10,000 or $11,000. I just feel, from long experience, particularly prosecutors, where we had mandatory minimums, like on suspended convictions in the past, and the courts would never use them. And I think that there are instances where if the judge is given the flexibility that a lot of the judges now are exercising, and we're getting a lot more flexibility, what I've seen by making young offenders go down to the detoxification clinic and work and do the kinds of things that are a lot harder on them than just paying a fine or sitting out in jail, that we get greater rehabilitation. And so I don't like to hear the contention that if you're against mandatory minimums that you're in favor of drunk drivers. And I know that the frustration that so many people have, and that the only thing that they can pin their frustration on is the court. But I've been down this road as long as anybody here, perhaps with the exception of, quite a while. And, you know, we increased the number. How many more state police do we have on the roads now, Gil? We have a whole lot more than we did in the past. We have our conviction rate way, way, way up. And I asked you the question when you came in front of the emergency board. Can you guarantee us, if we add these additional 100 police, if it'll reduce the number of drunk drivers? He said, no, and it hasn't. But we're doing all kinds of things. And I think the most meaningful thing is the tremendous flexibility that the courts, particularly the courts, are beginning to exercise. Getting these people into the offenders into the hospital, into the detox places, and really bringing them face to face with the carnage. And if you put a mandatory minimum in, you take away that flexibility.
Okay, Madam Chairman, I'd like to respond if I could on this. I wasn't aware that what I was saying was necessarily an indictment of the judiciary. I don't feel that way, and many of the laws that are in the governor's package come from the judiciary. But there is a point. I feel first of all, I'd like to point out the Oregon Traffic Safety Commission, the federal funds that flow through to the state for that new program with the new follow-up pre-sentence investigation program and the new treatment program for alcoholism flowed through the Oregon Traffic Safety Commission. The same commission came up with what you consider a tough deal with a minimum jail sentence. And there is a Harris survey that was published on November 20th, 1972 that shows that the general public sees no conflict between treating alcoholics generally tolerant to an alcoholic and being really cracking down tough with tougher laws on those who drive. It shows that a majority of the people don't think alcoholics should be fired, they should be helped. A majority of the people believe it's a medical rather than a criminal problem. And yet when asked, should the judges and courts be tougher on drunk drivers, 79% said yes, only 11% said no. So I really don't feel that there's two poles on this. I think it can go along in the same manner, and we definitely support and agree with the attempts at rehabilitation. In fact, there weren't any until we provided the federal funds for these programs in Portland. But I don't see any conflict between this and drawing the line, saying, okay, now we're saying we're quarantining you for 7 years and not to rehabilitate anymore, but just to stop you.
The committee is adjourning until 4 o'clock.